We're confronting uncomfortable conversations about money here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. There is that expression that friends and money don't mix, that it can ruin the relationship. But in the pandemic, financial hardships may be hitting your loved ones, maybe hitting you, and the conversation doesn't have to be strained or awkward. What is a tough money conversation you're not sure how to have? Share your situation, 800-642-1234. Aaron Lowry is a personal finance expert and author of the Broke Millennial Personal Finance Book Series. Her latest book is called Broke Millennial Talks Money, Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. Aaron, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. So wonderful to be back here.
Well, you know, we make financial decisions every single day, but why do we bristle when it is time to have a talk about money?
I think it can really be summed up in one word, and that's judgment. We are often very concerned that our choices are going to be judged by the person with whom we're having the conversation. And I think nothing surmises that more than the fact that we're usually willing to have intense conversations with strangers. You know, back when we could fly and all of those times, you are probably going to have a more intense conversation with your seatmate on an airplane than possibly even your best friend, because low stakes, you're probably never going to see that seatmate again, and you don't really care if they judge you.
Yeah, yeah. So we're more prone to open up when there is less risk, because it is risky if we have that conversation.
It really can be. And in some situations, it can feel really high stakes, and that it can potentially disrupt the foundation of a particular relationship.
Well, let's start with work and looking at your playbook here. You want us to talk about our salaries with coworkers. Why should we do that?
Well, this one, and I know that that can be a bit of a controversial take, and I do want to preface it by saying only if it feels safe to do that at work, and we can get into other ways that you can get the information without directly asking your coworkers in your office. But I want you to do it so that you have the information. It's hard to negotiate. It's hard to ask for more if you don't have the information about how much you're being paid. And I share a story in the book where I thought that I had negotiated a good deal for myself on a speaking engagement, come to find out when I asked another woman how much she was making, and controlling for similar factors, we were the same age, same experience, coming from the same city for the speaking engagement, and she was making double what I was. And if I hadn't asked her, I never would have known and would have continued to undercharge for my services based on what the market would bear.
But in that situation, when you were asked for your fee, you were kind of caught flat-footed. You really didn't have a good foundation for what amount of money, what number to ask for.
Exactly. And I think that, again, that's a good example of why, if particularly for people who are self-employed, freelancers, or small business owners, you need to start asking other people what the market will bear, because otherwise you don't know. And particularly for people who are not traditionally employed, there's not an option to go to a salary.com or a glassdoor.com or any of those websites that aggregate information. Now, if you do work in a more traditional work environment, you might have those resources, but you know, that's data that's being collected from all over the country, and it might not be specifically niched to your area. And you want to know what people in your actual office are starting to earn, or at least in your town, working in a very similar type job.
So the idea of asking coworkers about salary is difficult. How do you start this conversation? What would it sound like?
Well, first, you want to make sure you're asking the right person, and you also want to ask multiple people. So you need to have somebody that's a more comparable job to what you're working, similar title, or has just been promoted out and can give you information. One of the strategies that I personally love, I've had it used on me, I've used it on other people, is the over-under strategy. So it gives the person an out. You can say, give context about why you're asking. You know, I have a conversation coming up and I was planning to ask for a raise, and I want to make sure that I am asking within the appropriate number. I think that you could help me with that information. Could you tell me, do you earn over or under? And then you insert the salary number there. So do you earn over or under $45,000? If they say over, you could keep pushing, you know, over under 50, over under 55, however you want to do it. And the person might even feel comfortable enough to say, oh, I'll just tell you, you know, I earn 52,000 or what have you.
Yeah, yeah. So you kind of just feel it out as to where, you know, what the situation may bear, but also you understand exactly making sure that the context is right. I mean, finding out someone's salary in San Francisco, very different than cost of living in, say, you know, the middle of North Dakota.
Absolutely. And I also think that for people who are listening and feel like, well, I don't have anyone that I can ask at work, or I don't feel comfortable asking at work for a variety of reasons, that's also when you can turn to social media tools such as LinkedIn and can just cold pitch people asking them, how much do you make? And you can use sort of a similar script of, hi, I'm planning to ask for a promotion or a raise soon, or I'm going out on job interviews and I'm just trying to get a sense of proper compensation for this role. Could you tell me how much you earn, or, you know, use the over under strategy? Yeah. Thank you so much. Sometimes people get curious too. You could also tag out with, I'm happy to follow up with you and let you know how it went.
Yeah. We're talking with Erin Lowry. She's the author of the Broke Millennial series. Her newest one is called Broke Millennial Talks Money: Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. You can join in with what conversation you're having about money. Is your parent resistant to talking about the future with you? Like if they want to live with you or in a long-term care facility? What is your biggest financial conflict about money with your partner or family? And how do you have those conversations? 800-642-1234. So, Erin, you sit down with your supervisor and want to talk about actual negotiations. What kind of language should you be using?
Well, one of the first strategies really is that you need to be asking early for constructive criticism. I think one of the things that a lot of us, and I myself have made this mistake, is waiting until that performance review time of year to ask for your raise. Problem is, some companies have already set their budgets. So they're like, there's no more money to give you this raise. So you have to ask earlier. Now, the negotiation experts I interviewed made the point of really 3 to 4 months prior to that performance review, or whenever raises get sent and handed out, is really when you want to be asking and telling, listen, I want a raise. One of the great ways to do that is the old constructive criticism, asking early for, yeah, I'm interested in either getting a promotion, I'm interested in getting this amount, what can I do to get there? And then go out and do it. So you demonstrate that you've done what they've asked, and then be blunt in asking for your raise. The other thing that so many of us mess up on is this idea of talking ourselves back. So one of the negotiation experts made this excellent point of silence is golden. And I know that in some negotiation situations, we've been told, don't talk first. If you talk first, you lose. Well, if you're asking for a raise, you have to make the ask.
You have to,
so
yeah.
Often in this situation, not the case. So you need to make the ask and then be quiet. Don't say anything. And just try to hang on 5 seconds. People don't like to sit in silence. Just hold out for 5 more seconds to see what they say.
And so something might come of that. What other things can you negotiate outside of salary?
So you can negotiate for your benefits in a lot of situations. Obviously, in the pandemic, we've been in slightly unprecedented times of being able to work remotely. That was typically a classic example of, you know, a day or two at home working remotely. And as things start to reopen, as life possibly gets back to normal soon, that might be a conversation you need to have. Parental leave being another good example of trying to negotiate that as well.
Erin Lowry, author of the Broke Millennial series, a personal finance expert. Money is emotional and complicated, and we make financial decisions every day. So why is it so hard to talk about them? What is your biggest conflict about money with your partner, your family? Is the power dynamic in your relationship based on who has the higher income? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour on thorny money conversations and how to have them here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Personal finance expert Erin Lowry says it all boils down to boundaries and communication. Have you ever asked someone, hey, how much do you make? What happened after that? Have you talked with coworkers or friends about what they make? What was your reason for asking? How did you start the subject? It's 800-642-1234 to share. Personal finance author Erin Lowry is our guide to these conversations. So Erin, talking about money with friends can be awkward as well. In what ways can information about your salary or your friend's salary affect a relationship?
This one is such a good question because we all get curious, and there are times where I think we all want that information, especially if our friend is spending in a way that we're like, how are you affording that? But fundamentally, that really can disrupt the dynamic if there's the opportunity for you to get a little envious or vice versa. I think we just have to acknowledge that that is something that we as humans are basically hardwired to feel. If somebody has more than us, we tend to have that little green monster creep in. So I would not ask your friend what their salary is unless it is pertinent to you in the negotiation that you're about to do. If your friend works a similar job or maybe is a step ahead of you at work, and that's information that can actually be helpful, well, maybe in that case, sure. But if your friend has, you know, expanded in their job responsibility, seemingly making a lot more now, you're in different paths, or maybe you have just such desperate, disparate jobs where you're a public school teacher, they're an investment banker, let's not be comparing salaries.
So what is it about that conversation with a friend about money that can be a little bit risky?
I think the biggest risk is feeling like, hey, we started out in a similar footing if that was the case, particularly if this is a childhood friend or a college friend, and now all of a sudden we're in such different financial situations. And sometimes that can be about milestones that were achieved or decisions that got made, you know, when you get married, when you start a family, when you buy property, those kind of big financial decisions. In other situations, it can just be about careers or other choices. And it's hard to contain that feeling of, oh, they're so lucky. They make so much. I'm so jealous. And you don't have all the facts, but that's probably going to be the baseline emotion that happens.
You want people to seriously consider sharing their debt number with friends. What good would this do?
Now, if you feel uncomfortable with the number, that's fine. But sharing the existence of debt can be really helpful for a few reasons. One, it could end up being a built-in accountability buddy. Your friend might also have some form of debt, whether that's student loans, an auto loan, credit card debt. And if you're both working to pay it off, you can hold each other accountable and be a support system for each other, which is one of the beautiful options. But the other one is that it gives your friends context for the way that you're making decisions and why you might be saying no. I think some of the times, especially if we get on very serious financial journeys for ourselves, we start to say no to everything. No to the invitations, no to the trips, no to, you know, the weddings, whatever it is. And if you don't give your friends context, they're going to start making up answers for themselves about why you're saying no. And let's be honest, we humans are a little bit self-centered creatures. And I think that they're probably going to feel like it's about them and not about you. And that can really damage the friendship. If you keep saying no, but you don't tell them why, you know, no, I'm not going to do that because I'm trying to pay off student loans by the end of the year. And I would also provide a counter, but how about you come over for game night instead? If you don't give them that information, they're sitting there thinking, wow, every time I ask them to do something, they just say no. And that kind of hurts my feelings.
You did mention a very expensive wedding, and that could also be really difficult because it's tied with emotions, friendship. You want to be there and support that person. How do you handle that type of situation when you can't afford the wedding?
I would love to say that it always works out when you have an honest, frank conversation with each other. But to be honest, it doesn't. I've been in a situation where I tried to set financial boundaries being in a friend's wedding, and it didn't end well for us in our friendship because people get very emotional about their weddings. But I do think it's incredibly important that, especially if you're being asked to go to a bunch or be in a bunch, that you do set financial boundaries for yourself and give alternatives and don't make it sound like a judgment on their choices. That's the dangerous part, is saying, you know, you just picked a bridesmaid's dress. It's insanely expensive and I can't afford that. Not the right way to have this conversation. Really more, again, about context. I really want to be in your wedding. I love and support you. However, I have three other weddings to go to this year. All of them are out of state. I'm just trying to handle my budget. So I can't afford to do the bachelorette party and the bridal shower and the wedding. Could you let me know, other than the wedding, which is more important to you? And giving them a choice. So doing options like that. Or honestly saying no to being in the wedding in the first place if you think it's going to put a financial strain on you, and then on the back end, a strain on the relationship. And being very gentle about it and telling them very early, because fewer things are worse than agreeing to do something for somebody and then, you know, whining behind the scenes about it and trying to get other people to commiserate with you. And that's fundamentally going to get back to your friend sooner or later.
Yeah, not productive. We are learning how to navigate difficult financial situations, money conversations with the people closest to us. Erin Lowry is our guide. She is the author of the Broke Millennial Financial Book Series. You can join in. What is a tough money conversation you're not sure how to have? Do you worry about a relationship that might be based more on who makes more? Does that work for you? Or are you looking for advice on how to change that? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Erin, how can we maintain a relationship when you mentioned the public school teacher and the financial, broker, someone who works on Wall Street, maybe, leading two very different lifestyles? Can there still be a friendship?
There certainly can be a friendship. I do, though, feel that it's important to acknowledge that as we age, as life happens, we do tend to ultimately go into groups that more similarly reflect our lived experience. So I talk about in the book how oftentimes I think parents will look up at parties and they're surrounded by other parents. People that are married or in long-term relationships often don't have single friends. We tend to just kind of cling on to people who have that similar lived experience, and socioeconomic status often ends up being a part of that. Now, can you remain friends? Of course. But it also sometimes requires having these what can be uncomfortable conversations. If your friend financially cannot afford to be going to the restaurants or going to the events or taking the kind of vacations that you want to be taking, you might stop asking, or you might get resentful that you're having to do, a budget version because your friend can't afford it or they won't let you pay. But on the flip side, if you're the friend, that can also be a really frustrating feeling. So you have to acknowledge and have the conversation. Otherwise, resentment's going to build and you're probably just going to drift away. But another conversation another point that a financial psychologist made is that not all friendships are lifelong friendships. And that's not to say that every time a friendship gets uncomfortable, you phase somebody out. Absolutely not the case. But also acknowledging that every friendship that we make is not a friendship for life. Sometimes it's for seasons of our lives as well.
Well, let's talk about setting those financial boundaries. And you say that group dinners were invented to test our ability to set boundaries. Can you explain that?
Oh, yes. I am sure everyone listening has had a moment where you've gone out to a dinner, whether it's a birthday dinner, a celebratory dinner, or work, and that bill comes at the end of the night, and somebody's like, oh, let's just split the check. And you had the side salad and a Coke. And that person down there had two drinks and an entree and an appetizer. And you're like, I don't want to foot the bill for that guy. So this is the time where you have to stand up and say something. And that is where that it mentioned in the beginning, that judgment feeling, that's where that starts to creep in. Well, if I stand up and say this, people are going to think I can't afford it. And, that's just kind of embarrassing. And I'll just suck it up and pay this. No, you can stand up and advocate for yourself. One of my favorite lines about this was a woman in the book who says, what is more important, the resentment that's going to keep breeding and you're going to be thinking about this in 3 days, or the temporary embarrassment that you might feel, but the relief that you're going to feel afterwards? So a few ways you can handle it. One, try to set boundaries before the dinner even starts. Saying to your friend, I'd love to come, but I can only spend X amount of money. Or saying at the beginning of the dinner, hey guys, I just want to let you know, I'm just going to pay for my share and maybe you kick in a little bit extra for whether it's the birthday girl or celebratory, whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
Another option is to just join at the end of the night for dessert, or meet them before for a happy hour beverage and actually skip out on the full dinner experience if you're just too stressed about having to advocate for yourself when the actual check arrives.
So what I'm hearing from you is really plan ahead here in order to not get stuck in these awkward situations.
It really is about planning ahead and advocating for yourself. And if you don't want to have to take all of those steps, it's also about feeling confident and comfortable enough at the end of the night to say, hey, I respect if the rest of you want to split the check evenly. I need to pay just for what I ordered, and I tried to order accordingly. So I'm going to pay X. And don't forget to include tax and tip. It's not just the price number on the menu. Do not forget about tax and tip.
We are tackling sticky money conversations. We have a personal finance author, Erin Lowry, as our guide. Her new book is called Broke Millennial Talks Money. Do you and your partner have separate or combined bank accounts? Why do you choose that? Did you skip a prenuptial agreement, later wished you hadn't? What happened? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Erin Lowry about Money Talks after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how to have uncomfortable money conversations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a playbook of sorts on how to initiate money conversations in a productive and healthy way, in a way that won't burn bridges or cause unsettling arguments with a spouse or family member. What tension do you have about money with your partner or family? Have you talked with someone about setting financial boundaries? Did you find a shared vision? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Erin Lowry's book is called Broke Millennial Talks Money: Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversation, and she is our guide. Erin, let's talk about parents. Why is it important that we ask parents what their retirement plan is?
A controversial take for many people, but at the end of the day, it's so important to be asking these questions because you want to make sure that your parents are going to be well cared for, and you want to have all of the information, because if, whether it's financially or physically, they're not going to be able to care for themselves as they age, you as the child need to know if you're going to need to step in some way. And for some people and for some cultures, that's just kind of a given. Of course, you're going to care for your parents financially. Perhaps they're going to move in with you. You already know this. But for other people, that's not really a conversation, nor is it necessarily an expectation. So having the conversation early can make sure that a plan is in place.
So how do you start that conversation with a parent that you don't want to be upsetting them or, forecasting what their life may be like in the future?
Yes, I love the term negative fortune telling. That is certainly not what we want to be doing here. Instead, you really want to engage just in the start in a conversation, and you want to be doing it very early before there's any signs of any kind of issue. And you might have a gut sense, but one of my favorite tactics that I love is this idea of asking for advice. So for instance, hey, mom and dad, I just got a new job and I'm trying to set up my 401k plan. What investments did you pick? Or how did you pick investments when you were setting up your retirement plan? And the answer might be, oh, I had a pension. I didn't have to worry about that. Or it might be, I never really actually did one of those. Or it might be, here's how we picked the investments for our retirement plan. Whatever the answer is, it gives you some insight. Now, maybe that's not an authentic way to communicate with your parents. Maybe they know you're the money nerd and they're not necessarily. And so they're like, well, that doesn't make sense. They're clearly mining for information. So it can also be something like, hey, my friend Jackie's parents just retired and moved down to Florida. And I was just curious, what are you guys thinking about for retirement? And just see what they say.
Yeah. So just kind of getting a little bit of a toe dip there to see, and this might happen decades before retirement, even. This could be, in their 50s, maybe even, early 60s.
Yes. And the earlier you can initiate this conversation, the better. I would love it if people are always having it even 10 to 15 years before their parents are truly thinking about retiring. And I also just think that it's so important to also be checking in with your parents about estate planning. And I don't mean a will. I mean really making sure that the paperwork for making decisions, if they're unable to make decisions for themselves, is in order. So we're talking things like power of attorney, advanced healthcare directives. That kind of paperwork is so critical to make sure is handled and that you actually physically know where the documents are so you can access them. Because the last thing you need in a high stress time is also realizing there's nothing I can do legally. I can't step in and intervene in this situation.
Yeah. Looking at long-term care facilities, retirement communities, nursing homes, that is also very daunting, emotional, and very expensive. How do you broach that conversation?
The first thing is to not bulldoze. That is where I think a lot of people end up going wrong. And there's such a trope, whether it's, you know, in TV shows or movies or just what you hear from friends about mom or dad has a spill and, you know, breaks a hip, or mom and dad forgets to turn off the stovetop, and you just immediately jump to, well, you can't live by yourself anymore. You have to go do this. That's not fair. They're still an adult as well. You can't just bulldoze. You do need to have an empathetic, open conversation. But the other thing that you do need to consider is if long-term you think that that might have to happen, particularly if there's a family medical history of perhaps whether it's Alzheimer or dementia, and you think that you're going to need other support outside of the family. One idea is to start an emergency fund early for your parents and talking to siblings, if you have them, about also contributing to this fund. So setting aside money every month with them in mind, hopefully to supplement any financial groundwork that they've already laid for themselves. And the other thing too, if you're an investor, is to kind of invest with them in mind for at least some of your money, putting the kind of risk on it or not the kind of risk on it that you would with the time horizon, the amount of time until you think it's going to be necessary to use that money for your parents. But to kind of take control into your own hands and your own financial life of, hey, I'm going to need to financially care for my parents and I want to make sure I'm prepared for that and that I can still take care of my family or myself as well as my parents.
We're talking with Erin Lowry, who writes about Money Matters. Her latest book is a guide on how to talk about money with coworkers, with family, with parents, with friends, romantic partners. You can join in with a sticky situation about money. You join in at 800-642-1234. So, Erin, you know, when it comes to caring for parents and dividing up responsibilities among multiple siblings, should one sibling head up care efforts or coordinate, or should responsibilities be divided up? How do you do that fairly?
In an ideal world, of course, things are divided out equally and fairly, and everybody feels like there is equality and equity in the situation. But realistically, that's probably not going to happen. And you need to have conversations early with each other about that reality. You know, if you have some siblings that physically live closer to mom and dad and others who don't, then the ones who physically live closer will probably shoulder a lot of the, and I don't like to use the word burden, but the responsibilities of whether it's driving to doctor's appointments or physically going to check in or being more of the frontline emotional support for mom and dad as they're going through this life transition. So you need to make sure that you're having open conversations with the siblings who perhaps don't live nearby or who have a different family dynamic where they don't have the same amount of time and flexibility to provide that support. And maybe part of what it looks like is, hey, you might live 600 miles away and you can't drive here on a moment's notice, but I need to make sure that you're calling mom and dad at minimum once a week, or every other day, or whatever the family expectation is, so that they feel loved and checked in on. And that just takes something off of, you know, my mental plate. Maybe it's, hey, if you can't physically be here to do things, I need you to financially contribute a little bit more. But you also have to be sure you're having open conversations about the other obligations financially that your siblings might have. It might not just be your parents they're having to support. It also might be a spouse's parents, as well as having their own children. So there has to be conversation about, just because, or let me rephrase, contributing the same amount of money is not always what's fair. Mm-hmm. So there has to be open communication about what actually realistically will work and what is fair to each sibling.
And there can be so many little day-to-day things that can add up, whether it is a doctor's appointment, whether it is shoveling the walkway after loads of snow. Those are things that they need to be done. And yet usually if it is the one sibling who lives close by, it just seems like that is the obvious choice.
And that might be the, as you said, obvious choice for some of those day-to-day tasks. But then the other siblings need to be figuring out a way to provide emotional support and financial support to both that sibling and to mom and dad. So shoveling the snow is a great example where maybe a sibling who doesn't live there pays for a service that comes and takes care of that for mom and dad. So that's one less thing for the local sibling to have to be thinking about.
What about loaning family members money? What are your insights there?
I think whether it's a family member or a friend, if you're going to loan money, it is a gift, not a loan. That is how you need to reposition it in your mind. And if it gets paid back, great, a pleasant, unexpected surprise. But you should never loan money that you need and that you need back, because odds are good it's never going to actually get repaid. The other thing that's really hard is if you loan somebody money, you have now an emotional investment with how they spend their money. So if you see them post on Instagram that they just took a trip or even went out to dinner, or heck, it could be they went to Starbucks, you've got some feels because you think, well, that's $5 that could have been back in my pocket with the money that you owe me. So you have to really, for your own mental health, either not make the loan or reposition it as a gift that's a pleasant surprise if it gets paid back.
What about a loan to one of your children who may be trying to buy their first home?
Similar situation for a lot of parents, I think, of mentally frame it as a gift. Say it's a loan. Perhaps if, depending especially on your dynamic with your child, it might be helpful to structure some sort of repayment schedule. And that's one thing with loaning anyone money. As the loanee, the receiver, I think that sometimes in your head, you position it as, well, I can't pay them back until I have all the money to pay them back. And that's what starts to feel really daunting, as opposed to just like with any other loan to an actual financial institution, it would be an installment. So think about that way as well, where you're making an installment payment back to the person who loaned you money. So whether it's $10 a month or $100 a month, you are consistently paying them back. So they feel a little bit better too. And you can actually create those terms before you even receive the money.
We have personal finance expert Erin Lowry, author of the Broke Millennial series. She's helping us navigate strained or awkward money conversations this hour. Have your conversations become more candid or open with a loved one in these difficult times? If you've had talks about money with your partner, where are those pain points? What can't you seem to get past? Still time to talk it through. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Erin Lowry right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with personal finance expert and author Erin Lowry. We've been talking about how to have candid and open conversations about money, especially in these difficult times. Erin is out with a new guidebook talking about money in every aspect of life, in work, in family, friends, relationships. It's all there. Erin, let's end on marriage here. How often in a marriage, when you see one spouse earning quite a bit more than the other, how is that metric used as couples weigh, you know, the power dynamics?
It can certainly be wielded as an issue, especially in fights. And I think that it is really critical that you consider reframing and having an our mentality about your finances when it comes to goal setting, as well as certain ways in which you spend and save. it's really not a healthy dynamic to long-term, even if you bank separately. It is not a healthy dynamic to say, you know, I make more money, therefore I am in the decision-making, you know, status, or I get to decide how we invest or how we save or what our goals are. This should be a collaboration. This should be a team conversation, no matter how you bank.
So when is it appropriate for couples to have a joint account versus separate bank accounts?
I don't think it makes a lot of sense to have a joint account until you are legally married. And the reason that I say that is because you have access to that joint account. Now, if you've started cohabitating prior to marriage and logistically it's easier to put some money in a joint account for certain shared bills, sure. But to put all of your money in there, if something goes sideways, that person is entitled to go and drain that bank account. And if you're not married, there's not necessarily the, you know, you go in front of a judge in order to have to separate your assets. Now you could take them to small claims court, but that's a lot of work. So just from more of a protection standpoint, I don't think it's very prudent to have joint accounts until you are actually married. But once you are married, I don't think that that is any sort of requirement or obligation of marriage to have a joint account either.
So outside of marriage, if one partner is making more money than the other, should they still expect the other to split the cost of rent 50-50 or the mortgage equally? How does that work?
So this, and that's a great question because it kind of goes back to the conversation with your siblings about caring for parents, that doing something split down the middle, quote unquote, equally isn't necessarily fair. If one partner is making significantly more than the other partner, then it might not be fair to split the rent 50-50, especially if one partner wants to live in a nicer area of town, have a higher rent or a mortgage. So that needs to be an open conversation, possibly about prorating expenses. The other option too could be subsidizing certain parts of your cost of living so that the partner who doesn't earn as much doesn't have to worry about it. So maybe you split rent 50-50, but the higher earner pays for all of the groceries or all of the utilities or however you want to do it. But it is also important that whatever decision gets reached in the beginning of the cohabitation or the marriage, it doesn't have to stay that way forever. This can be an evolving conversation and decisions as certain things change in your life as well. So it is important to, I would say, at least once or twice a year, come back to that agreement that you have in place on how you handle your money and just make sure it still feels good for both parties.
We only have about a minute left here, but if you're in a budding relationship where you're just revealing financial situations and information, what should those types of discussions be like?
At the end, you need to reveal everything. But in the beginning, I think the easiest way to get into those conversations without a whole lot of pain is to talk about goal setting. To ask your partner, what is something that you want to achieve financially in the next 5 years? Let them answer, and then ask something such as, and what's standing in your way, or how are you going to get there? And that's a really easy way to ask about debt and other financial obligations without actually saying the word, you know, how much student loan debt do you have, or do you have credit card debt? So it can be a more holistic as well as reducing some of the pain conversation, and you're focusing on something positive, which are those financial goals that you have as an individual, and then also setting them as a couple.
Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me back. Always wonderful to be here.
Erin Lowry is a personal finance expert, author of the Broke Millennial Personal Finance book series, and her latest one is called Broke Millennial Talks Money: Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a musical family.
For the members of Tomahawk Circle, playing in a rural family band is a labor of love. This Lac de Flambeau Ojibwe drum group crisscrosses the country most years to share their music with an extended community of indigenous people. At powwows from Washington State to North Carolina, members of Tomahawk Circle surround a single animal hide drum and belt out songs in the Northern original style. Joe O'Connell with Chippewa Valley Museum's Sounds Like Home podcast brings us their story.
Good road music, too, when you're traveling on your own, 20, 30-hour drives. I'm used to it. All right, my name is William Mitchell Jr. I am from Lac du Flambeau. Tomahawk Circle, we're like all family, legit brothers.
My name is Henry Mitchell, a singer, part of the drum.
We're brothers here. Yeah, and this is my dad.
My name is William Mitchell Sr., and I'm just a singer of the drum.
So he's my dad.
Blake Wanape, just a singer.
Like, he's my cousin.
I'm William Mitchell.
And that's his nephew.
I'm just a singer as well.
I am the drum master, lead singer. Started this group back in 2006 when these guys were just young. There's apartment buildings not too far from where we're at, just down the road. We all grew up on it. It's the street name is Tomahawk Circle, so that's where we got our name because we all lived within walking distance of each other back in the day when these guys were little kids. We all get together. There's at least 10 of us. That's a good amount of singers. But then if you're short on singers, like we travel, so we got like drum brothers, they're called.
I'm not originally from here. I'm from Casino, Wisconsin. I'm a Menominee. And they just picked me up because I knew I could sing. So now I travel around with Tomahawk Circle.
And they're willing to help out or want to sing and stuff. So every pow we go to, we're pretty crewed up.
We usually go to like big contest powwows. All the way from east to west coast.
It's kind of like our summer grind.
We performed in California, Connecticut, Ann Arbor, Michigan, all the way up to New York, Florida, went up to Saskatchewan, Arizona, North Carolina, Alabama, from the state of Washington all the way to east coast of New York. So we're pretty busy, you know, we try to stay busy.
Well, there's competition singing and traditional singing. Competition singing, everything's got to be perfect. Sing good, you know, you get good scores, and hopefully we do good in the contest. If we get lucky, sometimes we take home a little extra cash. Sometimes it just pays for the trip.
What money we make, we probably spend that to get there, you know. We just go represent and have a good time, and we've been there and done it, you know. That's all we can say, you know. As long as we make it back home in one piece like we came, we're good to go to the next one.
In the end, it's definitely experience and seeing, like you mentioned, our drum bros or, you know, family from across the country. You know, it's a celebration of life. Everybody gets together. You know, they sing their songs. Everybody dances. And if they're hearing good music,
yeah,
you know, they
no
feel...
Paul, unless there's a drum. Get those dancers out there rocking. You hear those bells. Man, it's a good feeling. Yep, it's a good feeling.
That story about Tomahawk Circle was produced by Joe O'Connell. Portions of the music you heard come from the Tomahawk Circle CD, Just Beginning. Make sure to check out the Sounds Like Home podcast from Chippewa Valley Museum to hear a longer version of that story and more features on regional music. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.